The date is December 9th, 1988, and we're watching My Stepmother is an Alien. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is Beg to my Celeste.
Yes, I was hoping you were going to go that route. Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
The funny thing is, in my notes, I have Ron to my Steven, and this was just a last-minute decision on my part to to change it up.
Great, great minds think alike. In my head, I was like, beg to Celeste, beg to Celeste, beg to Celeste.
So this week, we are looking back at December 1988, when the movies and theaters were The Naked Gun, Tequila Sunrise, Scrooged, Cocoon the Return, and of course, our movie for today, My Stepmother is an Alien, which earned $13.8 million on a $19 million budget.
Yikes.
Yeah.
That hurts. And you know what else hurts? When a movie gets spoiled for you. So just be warned, there will be spoilers ahead. And if you don't want to have your feelings crushed as bad as this movie crushed its budget, or lack did not crush its budget. What is the phrase I'm looking for? Yeah, if you want to tank your life as bad as this movie tanked at the box office, please hit pause, go watch it, and then come back as we and hear what we have to say.
There must have been something about crushing expectations in there or something, right?
Yeah. Sometimes it's like I roll with it, and then I lose it halfway and have to pick up the pieces.
So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "She's gorgeous, and she's never been kissed. Needless to say, she's from another planet." So we are sexualizing Celeste right out of the gate. Immediately on the tagline, the misogyny is pretty thick just in the tagline.
Yes, 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 yes.
But that definitely may not be the best description of this movie. So let's go to Colin for a 60-second synopsis.
That's the only tagline for this movie?
Yep.
That's shocking.
Yep.
They put no effort.
Only one I could find, at least, yeah.
All right, well, here we go. As a man, you never know what it will take for you to land the girl of your dreams. For Stephen Mills, what it took was shooting a radar beam into space and accidentally disrupting the gravity of a distant planet, prompting said planet to send Celeste and her handbag sidekick, Bag, to investigate, believing they are under attack. Celeste and Steve hit it off, and in the span of 24 hours, he teaches her how to kiss, gives her a fireworks-inducing orgasm, and asks her to marry him, making her, for the sake of the movie's title, the alien stepmother to Steve's teenage daughter, Jessie. Will Steve learn the truth about his extraterrestrial bride? Will Celeste learn what it means to be human? Is there more than an eye in that bag? Let's find out on another episode of I Used to Like This One.
Yeah, I definitely have some questions about the physics of that bag.
Yeah.
For me, this is one of those movies that I saw when I was probably way too young. I know that for me, this was the second ever movie that I saw Kim Basinger in, mm-hmm. Batman being the first, even though this came out before Batman. But it was one of those that I remember it at the video store and going, oh, well, I liked her in Batman. Let's go see what else Vicky Vale has to offer. And I guess I liked it back then, but I don't know about this. Now, I know this week, it is Mother's Day weekend, and that's part of the reason why we decided to choose something that was so centered around moms. But this came up because we thought, hey, it's your wife's first official Mother's Day this year.
Yes,
it would be nice to do something that she likes.
Mm-hmm.
So My Stepmother is an Alien is one of these movies that your wife liked?
Yes, this, along with Kindergarten Cop, I think I mentioned that when we did that movie, but this is another one of my wife's favorite movies from her childhood.
And is it still?
I don't know. Honestly, watching it, I mean, it won't come as a shock to anyone by the time this is over, but this is definitely not one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
And like, throughout watching it, I was just sitting there and my wife was on her computer doing some work. And I would just, every now and then, just look over at her and be like, this is really one of your favorite movies, right? And it was one of those things, like, she would kind of, like, tune in and watch it for a little bit. And she was like, yeah, but I could tell, like, it's a nostalgia movie for sure, you know? Like,
yeah,
there's something about having watched it as a kid that she still appreciates about it. But it's hard to ignore the flaws in it as an adult.
Yeah. One of the ways that I thought about this movie is it's written like it's a kid's movie, but it's definitely not for kids.
That's what I kept telling her that. I was saying, like, if I just went based on the title of this movie, I would think that this was a G-rated, probably, like, straight-up kid's movie.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what I'd try to even think about, but like, I don't know, like Matilda almost, like that, like that kind of kids movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it is like, it is not at all. It's not even really about being a stepmother for starters. Like the title I found completely misleading.
Yeah, it would have been better if it was a situation where she was more immersed in their lives, and this came up after a couple of years was, oh wait, you're an alien? How did we not know this the whole time?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the stepmother part kind of becomes just a bit of an afterthought. Now, that's your wife's experience. What about you? Had you ever seen this movie at all? Or
I hadn't seen it before, before I met my wife. And even I remember, I think it was a movie that we used to always go to Value Village because there's no Blockbusters anymore, and look at any movies that were at Value Village. You can just buy movies for like $2 or whatever.
Yeah,
and we used to do that for kind of like a date night thing, and I think this was one of those where she found it and she really loved it, so we went back home and watched it. And my experience of it is more like watching it over my phone, because I just, even back then, it did not hook me in any fashion.
Okay.
And so I didn't even really remember anything about it from watching it with her that first time. And then now watching it this weekend was, and actually, you know, taking a minute to really soak it in, as it were, was, yeah, I don't know.
Well, alrighty, let's jump into My Stepmother is an Alien. It's directed by Richard Benjamin, who has 22 directing credits, but 45 acting credits. His other directorial credits are Marcy X, Milk Money, The Money Pit, Mermaids, Mrs. Winterbourne. It's produced by Ronald Parker, who has 10 total credits. Such classics as Legs and Zoo Man and Gargantua, you know, all those ones that I used to have posters of on my wall when I was a kid, because, you know, who wasn't a fan of Gargantua back in the day?
I was gonna say that those all sound like Mystery Science Theater 3000
a little bit. Yeah. It's also produced by Franklin R. Levy, who has most of the same credits, plus his last was Homeward Bound. Plus, he has a few of those softcore pornish type movies like For Ladies Only and Seduced.
Mm. That softcore porn guy actually makes a lot more sense. This movie makes a little bit more sense now that I think about it.
It's written by Jericho Stone, but he just goes by Jericho in this, like he's fucking Madonna or Cher or something. His writing credits are this and Matinee, which is that movie starring John Goodman. That's it. It's also written by Herschel Weingrod and Timothy Harris, who we've talked about a couple of times with Trading Places, Kindergarten Cop, also Space Jam, Twins, and Brewster's Millions. And it's also written by Jonathan Reynolds, who wrote The Distinguished Gentleman, Switching Channels, Mickey and Maude, Leonard Part 6, and that's it. So we've got a couple of writers on this movie that really don't have a very thick resume. I read apparently there are actually 10 writers total that took part in revising this script at one point or another, although only the four are listed.
Yeah.
But, you know, a movie with too many writers, kind of like Mortal Kombat Annihilation, is usually a recipe for disaster. And
well, especially considering the original writer intended for this movie to be like I can't remember, like an allegory or whatever for child abuse. and it was supposed to be like a dark drama, but the studio decided they would work better as a comedy, thus the army of rewriters to come in.
Whoa, okay. That's a very different movie.
Yeah.
Well, we open the movie on some cheesy synthesizer music, which turns to Tom Jones singing a cover of Prince's Kiss. We see outer space, and the title of the movie takes forever to scroll across the screen. I thought I was watching it at half speed for a moment there, because that just takes forever. And then they do the zoom out of the title and show it again. Like, there's 5 minutes of your movie right there.
The whole opening is just, it's so 80s, I hate it. I don't understand why. Like, every 80s movie we've watched so far either opens with this weird synthesizer music and the scroll over title, or it just opens on, like, obscure cityscapes.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. We end up seeing an enormous satellite dish and lightning, and this is the Haddock Research Facility, and we get introduced to Ron Mills, played by John Lovitz, who is from SNL, and we talked about him in Three Amigos. He pulls up in his Rolls Royce, and we also end up meeting the boss of the facility, Dr. Budlong, who is played by Joseph Mayer, who we talked about in Sister Act. He was the priest in Sister Act, and he says, if he thinks he's going to ruin any more equipment, he underestimates this facility. And so Ron Mills and Dr. Budlong end up going down to the office of Stephen Mills, who is played by Dan Aykroyd from SNL, and we talked about him in Trading Places. So he's got a very important science experiment that is coming up, and it all hinges on this bizarre weather.
It's like Frankenstein.
It's a very Frankenstein
just
moment.
Just needed the lightning.
Yes. And I find it amusing, though, that it's a very Ghostbusters-looking science lab with Dan Aykroyd running around flicking switches and turning knobs. And, oh, he's so busy in there.
I got real, when I was watching that scene, this opening scene, I got real Steve Guttenberg in Short Circuit vibes of just... The minute I saw Dan Aykroyd, I was just like, this actor, he doesn't belong in this setting for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It just seemed off.
Well, and the lightning looked just as fake in this as it did in Short Circuit.
I also realized on this, with Dr., what's his name, Buttlesworth?
I already forget. Budlong.
Budlong. With Dr. Budlong.
Yeah.
So, I think it's just because I've started rewatching Seinfeld for like the umpteenth time, but I didn't realize when we watched Sister Act, like, he's the guy with Farfel the dog.
Oh.
The one that leaves Jerry the dog on the plane, which is one of my favorite episodes of Seinfeld ever.
Huh. Every once in a while you get one of those guys that just makes such a lasting impression. Look at the soup Nazi. We saw him in Austin Powers, mm-hmm. and he's always going to be the soup Nazi.
Yeah.
So what I don't understand is he's trying to send a signal out into space to a distant point that he says would take 92 years to get to, and then 92 years back, it's the clouds of Magellan or wherever that he's sending it. And, of course, John Lovitz has the line, sounds like women's underwear. I don't understand how it sounds like women's underwear. But when he actually does send out the signal, why does it not take 92 years to get to? Is that because of the lightning? Is that because of these weather conditions? All of a sudden, it's an instantaneous signal.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Because it also doesn't make sense with the fact that, like, when Celeste does arrive, like, there's a whole thing when she gets to that party where all her references are, like, dated because of that 92 years gap.
Yeah.
But then, you're right, it doesn't make sense. Like, how did the disruption happen so instantaneously?
Yeah, it's almost like it went back in time.
Was it superpowered? Because of the buttons? I don't know.
Because of the brass buttons. So, we get this whole exciting scene where he's trying to set up his experiment with very exciting music playing while they're headed to the dish. But I realize Dan Aykroyd is just so good at spouting off scientific jargon. I don't know if I could handle some of these lines that he has. He has the same stuff in Ghostbusters, too. So the experiment goes off and, like, the science lab catches fire and he gets fired. So he heads home and we cut to Jesse Mills, played by Allison Hannigan, who we talked about in American Pie. This is like just a big reunion for us. We've got so many actors that we've already talked about. Of course, also from How I Met Your Mother. I read that Jesse could have been played by Alicia Goranson, who is probably best known as Becky from Roseanne.
Hmm.
Yeah, she had at least auditioned for the role. I don't know whether she was, you know, in the finals or anything, but
that's interesting. I'm trying to I'm not even a big Roseanne watcher. I'm trying to picture Becky, but all I can picture is
Sarah Gilbert.
Yeah, Sarah Gilbert, the other one.
Yeah, Becky's the blonde one that they recast with Sarah Chalke from Scrubs for the last couple seasons.
Okay.
And then now that Roseanne has come back and now the Connors, they went back to Alicia Goranson.
Oh, really?
So that's who's currently playing Becky, yeah. But yeah, Jesse is playing basketball. Man, is Allison Hannigan young in this movie. Oh my goodness.
I know, I was trying to think, like, obviously it's before Buffy. Mm-hmm. But I was like, she is young, but she also looks older than I would have expected for some reason.
Especially when you think about the fact that 11 years later is when she was in American Pie.
Yeah.
And she does only look like 14 or 15 in this case. I think she's only supposed to be 13, but...
Yeah. Yeah, for some reason when the credits rolled across and it said introducing Allison Hannigan,
yeah.
I was expecting her to be like... You know, 4 feet tall.
Yeah, seven years old.
Yeah.
You expected her to look like Seth Green does. Oh, exactly. My God, is he young. But we'll get there. So his experiment worked, but he got fired. And then they sit and reminisce about her mom for a bit. And we find out apparently Jesse is wearing a bra now. Their relationship is so bizarre to me. Like,
uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I
understand the teen daughter saying, hey, look at me, I'm hitting puberty or whatever, but I don't understand her investment in his sex life a little bit later. Like, it just, she seems to know a little too much for a kid that age.
Yeah. there's a few cringeworthy moments between those two where I'm just like, TMI.
Yeah.
Like, some things do not need to be discussed between parents and their offspring.
Yeah. So Steven gets ready to go to a party at his brother's house and keeps his socks in the oven for some reason. Like, this guy is just, he's obviously just a stereotypical, no social cues, nerdy scientist is all that we're trying to get across at this point, right?
Yeah.
Someone that shouldn't be a single dad. You know,
well, they also, yeah, they go through a lot of lengths to show that he has no game at all.
Yeah.
Like, there's that one point where him and Ron are like right at the beginning of the movie where they're walking and he asks, like, when was the last time that you dated a woman? And he's like 1986 or something like that.
Yeah.
Like 2 years before.
Yeah. So we cut to a sexy glamour shot of pantyhose being put on. And we hear a voice talking, and we find out eventually that this is going to be Bag. This is played by Anne Prentice, who, this is her last movie. Such cheesy special effects. But we get, like, all these, like, some shots of... they just sexualize her so much in this movie.
I was gonna say, when that foot comes on screen with just the stars in the background and everything like that, I was just thought to myself, this is probably some foot fetishist, like, wet dream. I just have this scene on loop.
Well, and at first, I mean, because it's the space in the background, I'm like, so am I forgetting that she's just floating out in space somewhere?
Yeah.
Until they pulled back and you saw that it was a window.
It's also just, like, later on you find out that they don't have sex. Romance seems to be, like, something that has gone by the wayside.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, why is she so sultry?
Mm-hmm.
Why would she be so, like, you know, puffing her hair and putting on the pantyhose and everything like that?
Well, I have to assume it's because of the insistence of Bag here.
Okay.
Because in this scene, she is busy telling Celeste that you'll be the most desirable woman on the planet.
Oh, right.
And it's just like, well... I mean, nice ego boost for Kim Basinger, but still, yeah, most desirable, that's a pretty high bar that you're setting there, Bag. But this whole plan, she's only going to be there for 24 hours, and we see the ship land with more cheesy special effects, and then it opens up, and we get the full reveal of her and that terrible fucking hat, and rings in her dress like she's a fucking Jetson. Like...
There's a lot of Kim Basinger, unfortunately. I don't know if it was just the style of the times, but there's some unfortunate wardrobe choices, in my opinion.
Yeah, but this is Kim Basinger, who was Vicki Vale in Batman. I read that Celeste could have been played by Shelley Long, and that makes me go back to that earlier comment of you'll be the most desirable woman on the planet. Shelley Long? Really?
Shelley Long. I need to see a picture of her.
Cheers, Shelley Long, yeah.
Oh, she's Diane?
Yeah, she would have been peak Cheers at this point.
Yeah, she's too girl next door to be the most desirable woman of all on the whole planet.
Yeah, like Kim Basinger is definitely a very attractive woman.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So she sends off the ship with her glowing purse. And then we're at Ron's house for this party. And if it looks familiar, it's because the exterior was used as Kelly and Donna's apartment in Beverly Hills 90210. But we see how awkward Steven is at this party. Why is he so bad at eating veggies and dip? How did he end up with like his entire upper lip covered in dip?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not like a milk mustache. It's pretty difficult. Like, what is the mechanic of eating a chip where you have so, like, you would have to have so much dip on that chip,
yeah,
for it to be able to crest your lip?
Or if it's veggies, like, you'd have to like fill up celery in the middle, like it's ants on a log, and eat it sideways like a cob of corn to get that. Like, but Celeste happens to show up at the party looking for Steve Mills. How does she know where he is? Like, how did they know where to land? Because you'd think the ship would have followed the beam and ended up landing at the Haddock Center.
Yeah, I had that question after. Was like, how did they even know he was involved?
Yeah.
Like, was it just through stroke of luck that through talking she realized, oh, he's a scientist and somehow, like, just read his mind or something like that? Like, I didn't understand how she traced it to him specifically.
Yeah, well, see, I don't understand a lot of Celeste's biology to begin with. So, but she walks up to this house, like, it's very intentional that she's headed to this house. They landed on that beach.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's...
And she's dressed to party.
Yeah, but, you know, we do get some fun moments from Celeste here. Like, Kim Basinger, she's actually pretty funny in this movie with some of the stuff that she does. But and she's like eating the cigarette as an hors d'oeuvre, and she smokes the carrot. But then she's just kind of batshit crazy the rest of the time, doing the tumbling. And like some of the lines that she has, she is very funny, I think, with her delivery of them.
Yeah, it was a bit for me to get used to.
Yeah.
Just because she's not the person in this movie that you expect to be the funny, like the comedic
You'd expect
driver.
It to be Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah.
Yeah. And once again, Dan Aykroyd is kind of the straight man.
Yeah.
Like, that's his shtick more than I thought it was with Saturday Night Live, Dan Aykroyd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he gets the straight man a lot.
Yeah, so it took me a little while to be like, oh yeah, she is kind of funny.
Yeah. But then she asks about his work, and, you know, because a pretty woman couldn't ever be interested in science, he kind of plays it off as, oh, you don't want to hear it, it's boring stuff. You know, this is guy stuff right here. But there is a point that they're about to kiss, and the daughter is at the party, Jesse is at the party, and she says, oh, they're going to kiss! So she's watching her dad... This is where they're a little bit creepy close. She's watching her dad, hoping that he gets some action.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love the line of, does he know how, which is from a very young Juliette Lewis. This was her debut movie, I believe.
Oh, wow. Yeah, she was very... I noticed her on the second viewing, just
yeah.
because by that time I had already done a little bit of research and saw that she was in it.
Yeah. Like, I think Christmas Vacation would have been after this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I always get a kick out of Christmas Vacation because of how young Johnny Galecki is. But at least as a young kid, Johnny Galecki still wasn't as awkward looking as Seth Green in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh my God. But yeah. And then Steven goes in for like the most awkward kiss ever.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, again, I feel like they really, really, really want you to see how inept this guy is at picking up girls.
Just drive it home.
So literally the only woman that would fall for him would be someone who wasn't from this planet.
Yup.
Which, I mean, we've all been there. We've all felt that way.
So Jessie, though, at this point gets her first clue that Celeste might be something odd because she sees that the purse can make dresses and then asks Steven, is this acceptable? And he says, is the drool apparent? So just zero game from Steven here. And then we end up finding out that the purse has a robo-snake. I love how every time they show the eye come out of the purse, it's very obvious that the purse is being held low enough in the frame so that the puppeteers can do whatever they're going to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that too, how immediately the shot is like right at the bottom of the person up, no matter where it is.
Yeah, or it's sitting on a couch or something like that, yeah. And then we also find out that the purse has, like, telekinetic powers as well. But then Steven takes Celeste to go to his work because she insists that it's not going to be boring. And then the purse ends up making IDs. So, you know, we find out the bag just has all sorts of skills.
Basically.
And so they go into the science lab. And Dr. Budlong ends up getting called and saying that Steven is there, but Steven's not supposed to be there. And so when he shows up to confront Steven in his office, she ends up like using the purse to send him out the window and across the building and then falling through the roof of his car. And he says, I should just go home and have some pie. So... What's going on? What's going on here? Like, did the purse like also like hypnotize him or something? Or is he just kind of like, nope, you know what? Steven can stay. Like, is it just what?
Also, how do you survive that fall?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you survive? Like, I mean, the way it is, it's like clearly he's being, it looks like he's being carried like telekinetically.
Yeah.
But so it's not really a fall, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. The purse just does what the purse does, it seems.
Yeah.
Whenever there's a need, the purse arrives.
Pretty much, yeah. So he takes her to see the satellite dish and then asks, do you mind if I kissed you? And she says, does it hurt? And he says, not the way I do it. So
that's a good line.
So he goes in for the kiss and goes right for the neck. Like, obviously, this is just so that, like, his face is far enough out of view and she can see over his shoulder. Like, it's the staging is intentional, but in what world do you go for the neck first?
The vampiric world.
In the vampiric world, yeah. Yeah, that hit me as soon as I said it, as soon as it was out of my mouth. So the purse, though, ends up playing examples of kissing for her to watch, and then it gets weird.
Yeah.
Because they show every example of movie kisses ever, and she starts imitating each one as it happens in front of her. But, like, he is in love with this, though. Like, after she is done, like, absolutely, I don't know,
licking him.
Licking him, and yeah, it's... He's just like, wow, that was amazing.
Yeah, I felt like that scene went on too long. It was funny, and then it kept going to the point of being awkward, I thought.
Yeah, yeah.
By the time they got to the lions and everything, I was like, oh, man.
He ends up taking her back home, though. Or she insists that he takes her back home. They take a look at Jesse first. And he's like, yeah, she's great. And then he goes into his room, hoping to get more action, and then doesn't close the door behind him.
He's an exhibitionist.
I guess so. Like, you literally just visited your teenage daughter, and you're going to go into your room and not even close the door behind you.
No.
But I do love the line, though, where they talk about sex. I want to have sex. And she goes, okay, we'll have sex. As soon as I find out what it is.
Yeah, I love that when she goes into the bathroom and is talking to Vague. Like, I don't feel like I was trying to think how people would feel now if this movie was made, and that the way that she was going to learn about what sex is by watching porn.
Yeah,
by watching Debbie Does Dusseldorf.
So, yes, she asks Bag, what is sex? And we get, a list of, like, gender and stuff like that. But number 4 is deleted. Why is it deleted? Well, that's why we gave it up 3,000 years ago. And she says, well, the kissing wasn't so bad. So Bag gives her some information to look at, like porno tapes, namely the classic Debbie Does Dallas. And I think that means it's time for Sponsorship Corner! Always on the lookout for product placements in movies. This week, My Stepmother is an Alien is brought to you by Hustler Magazine and the movie Debbie Does Dallas. However, upon further research, the other ones listed are Debbie Does Des Moines and Debbie Does Dusseldorf, but those two seem fictional. But Debbie Does Dallas is real. I 100% know that is.
Yeah. I think the sequel is Debbie Does Dallas Again.
Yeah, which came from a TV series that was on Showcase at one point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, where they were trying to find the next star of Debbie Does Dallas. But I own like 4 porno DVDs, and the Debbie Does Dallas Again box set, which comes with the original Debbie Does Dallas, is one of them. Also brought to you by Rolls-Royce, Ford and Honda, MIT, Cuisinart, Columbia Record House, ATL Video Cassettes, the books The Shining by Stephen King and Out on a Limb by Shirley MacLaine, Aunt Jemima Syrup, Smucker's Jam, Coca-Cola, the LA Lakers, Korg Keyboards, Trojan Condoms, Ralph's Supermarket, Ritz Crackers, Knudsen Milk, Seagram's 100, Piper's Scotch Whiskey, Nike, and the Slingshot Diner, which may or may not be real. And this has been Sponsorship Corner.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah. So she comes out of the bathroom, all ready for sex.
And for some reason, why is there air blowing?
Right!
Why is there... is his bathroom fan, A, on reverse and also so strong that it's giving her that look?
Yeah, it's rippling her negligee and blowing her hair. And then the sex scene, if you thought the kissing went on for a while, the sex scene goes on for a little bit too long, though, I think. Like, even, like, okay, I mean, she's nice to look at, but this whole entrance takes so long, and it's just all reactions from Dan Aykroyd, where he's, like, hitting his head on the headboard and stuff like that. Like, it just, yeah, it goes on so long.
Yeah.
And then ends in fireworks.
This is the point where I realized this isn't a kids' movie at all.
Yeah.
This scene specifically. But yeah. What, like, these fireworks, where do they come from? I did not understand that at all.
Yeah, because the last time we saw fireworks was on the dish, and it was Bag projecting those fireworks, but Bag has been left in the bathroom, so she wouldn't have wanted to be part of this. She was pissed off that she was left behind and unable to observe. Mm-hmm. Like, is this something that Celeste can do?
Yeah, like, where are the... My main question was, like, where do they come from? These miniature fireworks that don't burn the house down by being set off inside.
Yeah, yeah. But boy, she really likes the sex. And then, in some post-coital pillow talk, she accidentally spills too much of her intel that she has gathered because she knows about his ex-wife and everything like that. And he said, "Where'd you get all those details? I can just read it in your eyes," she says. And he just accepts it, and then she tries to get more sex. So she likes sex.
She's every man's dream, I guess.
The most desirable woman on the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah. While he's sleeping off, like, this sex coma of his, she goes downstairs, and we find out that she can activate a computer by holding her hand to the screen. Is she a robot woman or something? This is where I have questions about her biology.
I don't know. She has some weird, I don't know, she says at one point they use, like, 110% of their brain or something like that later.
Yeah, something like that. You know, because that's mathematically accurate.
So is there something about that allows her to just, like, she has some weird, like, connect, like, mentally,
yeah,
with things and with people, and
yeah, and yeah,
I'm not sure.
Like, because also after she looks at the computer for a bit, she goes to read a book by placing her arm in the middle of the pages.
Yeah.
And, like, goes through all the emotions as she's reading it. Like, she puts it in the works of Shakespeare, and she's laughing a bit, and then she's crying a bit, and then she's scared off immediately by putting it in The Shining. So, it just... I just... Yeah. Anyway, so we cut to the morning, and Jesse is busy having the breakfast of champions, Pop-Tarts, and a can of Coke. And then her dad comes in, And Jessie is so psyched that her dad got laid. Like, she practically high-fives him. Because at that point, Celeste comes in too, and, you know, there's no awkward...
Well, I mean, she heard everything, right? So the door was open.
The door was wide open. So just seems like the wrong reaction, though.
Yeah.
But then he says, would I scare you if I told you that I love you? And she says, I would, but only if you hit me at the same time. Which I thought was another fun line. But, like, his desperation is terrifying. Like, because this is where he asks her to marry him after, like, 8 hours of knowing this woman.
Yeah. Yeah, it... I mean, after a certain point, like, I feel like earlier on, they should have leaned more into whatever the situation is with Jesse's mom. I assume it's, like, I kind of just am assuming he's a widow.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it's ever stated if she died or not, but...
I think so. I think that's what they're discussing on the bench when they're reminiscing about her.
Okay.
Oh, she was so nice. Yeah, I think it's,
yeah,
a widow situation.
So I feel like they should have leaned more into that early on. And maybe it would have taken off a little bit of the stink of his desperation later. Like, because at a certain point, you kind of just stop feeling bad for him. Because you're just like, man, you need therapy, not a new wife.
Yeah. Like, there is a point during his wedding, which happens tomorrow, that he says that he married his first wife after only knowing her a week. So this is his MO. Like,
yeah.
He falls fast and hard and somehow has managed to find two different women that are willing to to do the same craziness. But he tells Celeste that, you know, she might have to think about it. So she goes for a walk and then goes to a baseball stadium to get a transmission from the elders back home. Can these guys only appear in big open spaces?
Yeah, that's what I took away from it. That's what it sounded like. It
seems like a flaw in the technology, you know? But they're trying to explain to her what marriage is, and they say, well, you cook and clean and bring him martinis. Oh, wait, that's the wrong decade. But they tell her there's only one drawback. You'll have to have more sex. And she says, I'm in! So now we cut to the wedding, which I guess is the very next day. Wait a minute, why was it nighttime when she was talking to the elders? Or was it like an enclosed baseball stadium with no lights on? I just realized it was dark out when she was talking to the elders.
Was it? I could have sworn it was light out.
Was it?
Yeah, I thought...
Maybe I'm just...
Because I remember them walking... Room. Yeah, I feel like it was during the day that she
okay.
went.
Okay. Well, anyway, so we're at the wedding, and that is such an ugly light blue tuxedo. But I don't understand why he's wearing this Dumb and Dumber tux. And his brother comes in, like, wearing, like, a traditional, like, English morning coat and everything like that. Like,
they really play up, like, his brother is very wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he's, like, yeah, he seems to be a little bit more posh. I couldn't help but be a little bit disgusted by Celeste's wedding dress. I don't know what it was about it. That heart-shaped, open back lace thing was just...
But, like, it's a turtleneck in the front.
But it's a turtleneck, yeah. It was too much.
like from the front, you look like you're Amish or something. But from the back, it's, like, it's all sexy. But, it was definitely a weird dress. But then Jesse walks in on Celeste eating batteries and talking to her purse. But then she goes to tell Dad, and Dad doesn't believe her. The weird thing I don't get about this turn is all of a sudden he's just like, you know, you're just looking for reasons to hate your new stepmother. But it's like, no, like literally 2 minutes ago, she was singing the praises of this woman. And then she comes back in tears and you just dismiss it.
I mean, like, he also offered Jesse no opportunity to even get to know this woman.
Yeah, that too.
Like, Jesse has maybe seen her for a total of maybe 2 hours at this point, probably. Like, I don't even know that they've had a conversation yet.
Mm-hmm. But Dad doesn't believe her. He's going to get married anyway. Oh, the other thing about the dress that I forgot about is that little crown on top.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not even a tiara. It's like a perfectly circle crown perched in the middle of her head.
Like, their wedding attire for both of these people looks like they found it just out of some, like, local theater troupe's costume closet.
Yeah, what's open right now? Well, the auditorium at the high school is done.
Yeah.
But during this scene, Celeste realizes that she'd look ridiculous carrying a purse down the aisle, so she has to leave Beg behind, and the dog ends up stealing the purse and tries to bury it in the yard, but then Purse, like, fights back after it buries it in the yard and ends up floating the dog up onto the roof.
Yeah.
And so Celeste runs out to rescue Beg, but for some reason, no one actually questions why the dog is on the roof, how the dog could possibly have gotten onto the roof.
They're all just so swept up in the day, you know how it is when you get married. It's just, you're just so focused on the love. You don't have time to question frivolous things like flying dogs.
And I do love how, while they're all distracted by the dog, Ron goes over and, in his John Lovitz way, "May I be the first to kiss the bride?" and then just goes for it. Like, he's so predatory in this moment. Jealous? John Lovitz? God.
John Lovitz, like, he can't help but just be creepy.
Yeah.
There's just something about that guy.
Yeah. So now we cut to, I don't know, how long is this time jump to the daughter getting ready for her dance? Is this the same night, or is this at least the next day? Because she's only got 24 hours to come, or her original mission was supposed to be 24 hours. How long does the planet actually have before it dies? Like, is this dance the same night as his wedding?
I'm not sure. It seemed like there wasn't a lot of, like, to be honest, the whole weddings thing seems like just a formality. Like, they had to throw it in to be so that, you know, stepmother and all. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might have made more sense if they had just gone to Vegas and got, like, a drive-through wedding or something like that rather than had a full ceremony.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of felt like the dance was shortly after. I didn't think there was a significant amount of time between.
But there's also a certain comfort level of how Celeste and Steven are hanging around the living room and, you know, it's, you know, and Celeste is giving out stepmotherly type advice.
But she says
that it feels like it's been a couple months. Is kind of, it's, that's how it feels. But
she says, like, at one point, because it's like the next, isn't it like the next day there? That's when she makes that massive meal where she makes everything on the,
yeah.
And at that point, Steve tells her, like, oh, like, just sit down, like, we're on our honeymoon.
Yeah.
Which leads me to believe it's like, back in the day, it was kind of like you got married and you went on your honeymoon immediately. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to me like it was right, like maybe like a couple days max, if not right after, like the next day.
You see, with the way the rest of this movie goes, I feel like it's like the very next day.
Yeah.
If anything, or like I said, that night.
Yeah.
Like they got married in the afternoon and she's going to the dance at night and then she makes breakfast the next day. I don't know. But yeah, she's getting ready for this dance, and the doorbell starts ringing, and there's knocking, and ringing, and knocking. Like, what an impatient little shit this Fred Glass is.
The only thing he needed to do is go back to the car and honk the horn.
Yeah. Yeah. But this is Seth Green, and to tie it back into the fact that I said this is kind of a reunion episode, you know, we talked about him and Austin Powers. Man, though, he's a goofy-looking kid. Mm-hmm. And so itty-bitty. I'm sorry, Seth Green. I love the stuff that you're in, but my God, you were an awkward-looking child.
Yeah.
So we end up cutting to Dr. Budlong getting a phone call from Carl Sagan. And we find out that it's actually a prank call from the purse to just kind of move the chess pieces into place here to make sure that Steven can get access to his lab. The voice of Carl Sagan, though, it's Harry Shearer from The Simpsons.
Which I thought
was hilarious because I'm pretty sure he's done Carl Sagan on The Simpsons as well.
I was going to say, when I heard that voice, I was like, this sounds like, it sounded like something I had heard, a voice I had heard on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, like, oh, I was like, oh, Carl Sagan must have been on The Simpsons at some point, sure.
Yeah, okay.
But now that you say that, that makes complete sense.
Yeah, it's like, oh, he kind of sounds like Principal Skinner. Okay, I see it now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Celeste takes the car while Steven ends up laying in another sex coma to go grocery shopping. So she starts the car with, like, her finger, and I just don't understand her physiology. But when she gets to the grocery store, I thought the bit with the money was kind of funny, where she pulls out the $1,000 bill and the woman's like, "Do you have anything smaller?" And then she takes out the tiny little $1,000 bill. It was a good moment. So Jesse coming home from her dance, though, witnesses Celeste drinking a car battery and witnesses her taking eggs out of boiling water with her bare hand and taking something out of the oven with her bare hands. She's really not very good at hiding on this planet, I gotta say that.
Mm-hmm. I do also wonder, you've mentioned, like, with her physiology and all that, like, she doesn't eat human food.
Yeah.
But she eats batteries regularly.
Mm-hmm.
As one does.
So, yeah, I'm curious how that, because it seems like her species or whatever is just, like, is humanoid, like, I'm assuming, if all the parts fit and everything like that, you know, like.
Yeah, he didn't call out anything bizarre in their sexcapades there. Like, it's.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird that, like, then they make the choice to have her, when it comes to, like, what she eats, be so. Because, I mean, I can get on board with all the telekinesis and the being able to control machines and all that. Like, I can get on board with that by the, you know, she uses 100 and whatever percent of her brain.
Still mathematically inaccurate, but yeah.
Yeah. But the eating batteries and all this stuff.
Yeah.
It just seems like a weird throw-in. It's like something that basically is just there for Jesse to see and be like, oh, something is weird. She must be an alien.
Yeah, because we find out that she can get nourishment from real food, apparently, because she loves that turkey sandwich that she gets fed a little bit later. But boy, I love the ridiculous amount of food at the breakfast table. Like, how she just keeps coming in and with more and more food. This is where Steven gets the phone call from his boss, Dr. Budlong, who, because of Carl Sagan's phone call, has offered Steven his job back, so Steven goes into work on Celeste's insistence, even though it's their honeymoon. And so while he heads off to work, this is where Jesse finds out about Celeste. And then it turns into a bit of a horror movie for a minute, with the shutters slamming shut, and Jesse is on the ceiling from the bag, and the bag is like saying, "We need to kill her." You know, like, it's just, this took a very dark turn very fast here.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently they have the ability to shut a dog up from barking.
Yeah, I don't, it's also like, what is like, how do these two alien species interact? What is the relationship between Beg and Celeste? Because it seems like Beg is actually kind of the one who's in control.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she seems to be the one who's leading the mission.
Yeah,
I don't know, it's all very strange.
I do love when Jesse is up on the ceiling at that one point, and Celeste is trying to get the answer of, what does your dad know about this beam that he sent out? He doesn't know anything. You should know him well enough to know that he doesn't lie. You know, after a day. Like, that seems like an odd reaction for Jesse to have, too. You should know him well enough. No, she really shouldn't at this point.
Yeah.
She manages to phone her dad at work. You know, and it's, you know, Dad, come home, the house is on fire. And Dad comes home to this big, tearful fight with Jesse. Like, I have to say, some great acting from Allison Hannigan, but just, again, so bizarre that her dad is not hearing any of it. This girl that he has been alone with for all this time since his wife, whatever happened to her.
Yeah, like, literally, and you're sharing the intimate details of your sex life with your daughter. That's how close you are. But when it comes to your relationship, you don't, with this woman that you've only known for maybe a week at this point, max, it's, you don't trust her. You don't want to believe her, like, look into it. You just dismiss.
Yeah, it's the power of pussy.
And the thing, too, is it's not even like she has him under some sort of mind control or anything like that.
Yeah, that might make sense.
It's just literally, it comes off as like, he's just so desperate for love.
So Jesse takes off on her bike with Celeste and Steven following after her, and then she almost gets hit by a car, but Celeste has to reveal her powers at this point in order to save Jesse's life. I guess she's a good stepmother after all. She's learned how to value human life. And now Jesse is all super loving of Celeste, but Steve has started drinking, and he is furious about this deception. So, I just don't get it. You know, like, okay, I understand that you're going to trust this woman now a bit more now that she saved your fucking life, but you'd think that Steve would be fascinated. Wasn't that the whole point of sending the beam out into space?
Yeah.
Was to hopefully get some sort of sign back, and now he's furious?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just like, things in this movie happen too fast. Like, the turns,
yeah.
The turns that the characters make happen so quickly.
Oh, 180s, all over the place, yeah.
That it makes it really hard to, like, get on board with anybody or how they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, like you said, it doesn't even make sense. It's like, Steve should just be more happy because he's got a hot wife. Plus, she's an alien, which would be kind of cool for someone like him. Like, what's really to be mad about?
Yeah.
That she lied, maybe? But it's like, she didn't even have the chance to, like...
Yeah, because, I mean, he starts grilling her. Where's your spaceship? Behind the moon, Steve. You know, we find out she's 1,296 years old and that she's never had sex. And so he has this line of, I married a virgin? Oh, mother would be so proud. Like, what?
Yeah.
And then aggressively tells her, if you want my secrets, you'll eat my sandwich. So he makes her eat his sandwich, but she loves it almost as much as sex. But Steve finds out that she is planning on leaving and he just wants her to stay. So what if he doesn't duplicate the transmission? And she says, well, my planet will die. And then it's pretty cold that the aliens end up finding out from them that their plan is to destroy Earth after the transmission is sent.
Yeah.
So even though he's willing to save their lives, they're just going to turn around and destroy all of Earth in return.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he should have just stayed with the woman of his dreams and let them all die then.
That is one of the things that also doesn't line up very well, is like when she's talking about her home planet. And, you know, they basically have no war because they're all peaceful because they're so highly evolved.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that their approach to Earth in this situation would be like, it seems like you guys have made a mistake and we would like to come and help you and fix it. Not, like, the idea of retaliation seems to be above them.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know what I mean? It doesn't really line up.
Yeah, maybe try a little diplomacy or something, you know?
Yeah.
So they end up heading out to Steve's lab, and she leaves Bag behind, but we found out that Bag is crafty, and she ends up prank calling Ron and gets Ron to take the purse to the lab. She's posing as Celeste, which I thought was actually really clever, posing as Celeste, and oh, hey, I forgot my purse. Can you bring that for me? So very, very clever. They manage to duplicate the results at the lab, though, because Steven realizes that it was the buttons on Ron's jacket that ended up short-circuiting everything, and I don't understand how cloth is a conductor, but I'm not a scientist.
I don't get how they link the static electricity creating shocks on the buttons to being this thing.
Yep.
Or even does lightning actually lead to more static electricity? Like, static electricity, I've always thought, is from friction.
Yeah.
Not from just molecules just in the air.
Well, but lightning is technically static electricity, though, because the molecules rub together,
mm-hmm.
and then the lightning hits, like it's, you know, a finger touching a light socket or something.
Is the scene with the shirt, you know how when he first talks about the shirt and the snaps, he says, oh, but they rust.
Yeah.
Was that actual rust, or did he get hit somehow by lightning during the initial one and those were burns?
Is that the same shirt?
Well, I think his brother, like, created that snap technology with the buttons that look like buttons on the outside or something like that.
Oh.
So I think he has multiple shirts that all have those steel buttons.
Okay. I don't know.
This movie doesn't lean that heavily into the science it even suggests, so I'm not going to waste too much time thinking about it, but if anybody goes back and watches the movie, maybe look out for that.
when the experiment is going on, or when they're duplicating the results, this is when Ron shows up, and they manage to kill the purse by throwing it into the electricity that's going on, and then this is when the elders from Celeste's home planet show up again, And this is why I wonder whether they need big open spaces, because they're inside this little room and then they go, well, can we step outside? And they teleport outside?
Yeah, except it's not even like when they get out that they're in the same position.
Yeah.
Like Steve and Celeste and all those people.
Yeah.
They literally go from being huddled around to then all of a sudden they're like standing in a straight line looking up.
Yeah. So Celeste pleads with them, tells them that there's great things here and, you know, humor and sex and, you know, and so they tell her to show us Jimmy Durante. And so we get them doing the Jimmy Durante song that I haven't mentioned yet in this movie, but, you know, This is what they're going to use to try to save all of humanity. But I do love, like, there's the moment of what was the song? Ever get the feeling that you wanted to stay? But got the feeling that you want to go. But then they watch it and they go, okay, kill them. So, but then one of the elders sneezes. And it's the sneeze that saves the human race because it makes the head tingle and the whole body feel alive. Are they there? Like, how do they sneeze? If they don't know what a sneeze is from their entire existence, why does he all of a sudden sneeze?
Yeah, I didn't think that they were there. I thought they were kind of being beamed in.
Like, you know, Emperor Snoke or something like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. They needed, I don't know.
So then, instead of just telling them, Celeste wants to show them. She says, can you see my eyes? Then this is why you should spare this planet. And we get a flashback of the entire movie. and then the elders say, this Earth deserves more study. It's too weird to destroy. It shall be spared. And so they say, Celeste, it's time to come home. And we find out that her job is chief extragalactic probist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they need her to come home, though, to tell her everything that they found. Instead, we decide that we're going to send John Lovitz as our representative of Earth to teach them everything that he knows about sex. And there is the line of, does everyone up there look as good as she does? And they say, better. And Dan Aykroyd has a really good reaction of, really? Should I have held out? You know, like... But the ship shows up, it opens up, and we find out that everyone that's on board this ship that is going to take Ron back to their home planet looks just like Princess Stephanie, who he thinks is the perfect woman. And so he is allowed to take his Rolls Royce. And I love hearing some of the women talking as he's getting onto the ship with his car, where they're like, it's a car, Rolls Royce, one of them says breathlessly. The elders say, we'll be in touch. Enjoy your humanity while it lasts. And then Celeste and Stephen go back home. Stephen tells his daughter that we're going to go upstairs and get some sleep. To which Jesse responds with, I get it.
Oh my gosh.
This kid knows way too much about her dad's sex life.
They need to set boundaries. Yeah. They have unhealthy boundaries in this relationship.
But Celeste does hang out for a minute, helps make Jesse slam dunk, which is Jesse's dream, is slam dunking the ball. And then Celeste disappears. And then within seconds, we see fireworks outside the bedroom upstairs, which we know what that means. But this is short, even by my standards. Come on, like.
And I mean, yeah.
But then Jesse gets this look on her face where, like, she smiles like, I know what just happened. Oh, yeah. She's giggity, like, giggity, you know? Like, yeah.
Good job, Dad. She might as well have just, like, the shot might as well have just ended with her giving a thumbs up.
Or running inside and high-fiving him in his bedroom. And then we get credits. And I don't know if you waited till after the credits, but there is some post-credit stuff in this movie.
Oh, I didn't know.
It's a clip of Jimmy Durante, and that's all the post-credits scene was, but I thought it was kind of neat because they definitely had a couple thank yous in the credits to Jimmy Durante's family and all that sort of thing. But yeah, there was a little bit post-credit Jimmy Durante stuff.
Nice.
And that is My Stepmother is an Alien. Whew, what a journey.
Yeah.
So, Colin, on IMDb, it scored 5.4 out of 10, and I've never seen this before, but it has no Metascore.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 19% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 30%. But, Colin, those are just numbers. Like a lightning bolt to a satellite dish. Hit us with some reviews.
All right. Our first review comes from Rotten Tomatoes user Paul D. 3 out of 5 stars, he says, "This movie certainly isn't gonna go down as one of the greats. It is cheesy and kind of dumb. That being said, it made me laugh often anyway. I can't recommend this movie, but I think those who can appreciate cheesy movies for what they are might be able to have some fun with it. This is a guilty pleasure, but certainly not quality cinema."
Yeah, that's fairly accurate. Without hearing any of the other reviews yet, I feel like that kind of sums up my opinion. But let's see what someone else has to say.
All right. TihoJS, 2.5 out of 5 stars, says, "See, kids, back in the olden days, we didn't have internet. If you wanted to get your rocks off, you had to either do the walk of shame and buy one of those dirty magazines while the store clerk judges you. But if you were rich and lived/worked in Hollywood, you wrote a comedy script and hired a sexy lady. I think Dan Aykroyd just really wanted to see Kim Basinger's boobs. That's basically it. There's some subplot about an alien trying to figure out if a scientist tried to kill their planet, but that's only 10 minutes of the movie. You can laugh at the absurdity and how innocently sexist it is, but that doesn't make it not sexist. Or filthy. And don't get me started on Allison Hannigan having a giggle because her dad has orgasms."
Oh, boy.
All right, Scott M., 1 out of 5 stars, says, "Awful, quote-unquote, comedy. I watched this once when it was shown on network television, and I hated it. I can imagine that the only reason why this is available on DVD is because, quote, starring Academy Award winner Kim Basinger, LA Confidential, can be printed in the blurb on the back cover." And then finally, Gareth R., 1.5 out of 5 stars, and this is an abridged version. I'm only going to give you like the first couple sentences. But anybody who wants to should go on Rotten Tomatoes and find this review because it's hilarious. He gives this line, these couple lines that I'll read, but then he actually goes into dissecting the plot.
Okay.
And it's pretty comical. So he says, "I bought My Stepmother as an Alien for next to nothing in a supermarket, as I vaguely recalled liking it years ago. I want my money back. Look, there's nothing wrong with being frivolous. There's nothing wrong, say, with a sci-fi comedy that perhaps doesn't go out of its way to explain the sci-fi part. Although, with 4 credited screenwriters, you might be forgiven for expecting such a thing. But something, be it the plot, the characterization, or even the jokes, must make sense, and My Stepmother is an Alien just doesn't. Staggering and fumbling from one idea to the next like somebody spiked its drink."
Nice.
There you go. Those are our reviews for this week.
Right on. Yeah, so 5.4 for IMDb, no Metascore, 19% and 30% on Rotten Tomatoes. Where does it fall for you?
I mean, I'd probably fall on the side of, like, the Rotten Tomatoes for sure. I think this movie... you know what? I like Monster Squad more than I like this movie. Like, I would watch Monster Squad 100 times before I ever watch this movie again.
I like how Monster Squad has become our baseline on this show.
The only movie I probably would be a toss-up that we've watched of whether or not I would watch it again before I watch this would be The Secret of My Success. I think these movies are on the same level for me. Like, I don't know what it is. This movie, it's just... things didn't make sense. It's one of those things I told my wife after I was done watching it. I was just like, I guess you just had to be there in 1988 to watch this movie. I don't know. I mean, clearly, like, people, not a lot of people liked it at the time it came out either, because it bombed big at the box office, so.
Yeah.
And it's also funny because Dan Aykroyd is, like, a guy that you hear about, and I haven't watched a lot of his movies, but I would not be, after watching this one, I'd be a little bit, I don't know what the draw is. I guess he was on SNL, but mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know. This movie is just, I don't want to watch it again, is pretty much how I'll sum up my thoughts about it.
Fair enough. Yeah, I know for me, this is one that I can understand why I liked it as a kid. But now that I'm watching it with adult eyes, there really isn't much of a story there. I mean, you know, it's so much of it was over my head when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, at this point, it's just like, oh, well, okay, the story just isn't very good. Like, was I just obsessed enough with Ghostbusters that he's a Ghostbuster-like character, or Short Circuit and he's a Short Circuit-like character, or the Batman of it all with Kim Basinger looking good in that negligee?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, props to Kim Basinger.
Yeah. Is that what 12-year-old Sean really saw in this movie? Was the, oh, it's a dirty movie, but it's not really that dirty, but...
That is kind of the weird thing that I was trying to figure out, because, yeah, it seems like people, even reading the reviews, it was like, as people treat it like it's a kid's movie.
Yeah.
All the reviews that were very positive were like, oh, I love this movie when I was a kid. I love this movie when I was a kid. Like, you know, it brings me back to when I was a kid, blah, blah, blah. But I struggled to think about, if I was watching this as a kid, what would have been the draw? Mm-hmm. Because all, like, Kim Basinger.
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
She is,
either.
I don't even remember what it is. But she does have, like, a lot of good, funny moments.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all predicated around kind of, like, sex stuff that I feel like would have, if I was watching it as a kid, would have gone right over my head.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I look at this movie, and it's kind of like that first review that you read, where I can pick out parts that I really did enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
There were moments that I thoroughly did enjoy, and it's like that party scene.
Yeah.
But then it's just surrounded by so much nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
That I couldn't really get on board. Like, the 24-hour marriage was just... That was just something I couldn't get past.
Yeah.
And it's the adult brain in me. Maybe as a kid, it felt like there was more time passing, or like I wasn't following the story well enough. But as an adult, it's like, no, he met her yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
How are they putting this shotgun wedding together so fast? Like, it just, yeah, for me, this is like, you know, I'm gonna go down to 25 on this one. I enjoyed some stuff in it. I got some good laughs. There were some good lines. Like you said, some of it was very just based in the sexuality of it all. And
mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think now that I've seen it as an adult, I remember it again. And I think that may have been the last time that I ever watched this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, it's just...
Not going to go and show my kids, that's for sure.
Definitely not.
Well, there we go. That is My Stepmother is an Alien, and that's our show for this week. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is, well, tell your friends. Share our posts. Word of mouth is so important for a podcast that is starting to build from the ground up. We don't have celebrity status on this show, so everybody that you tell just helps us more than you can imagine. Or if you want to go above and beyond and help us, just go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't matter what you say. It's not for our egos, but it's those 5 stars. They drive us up the charts and they just help us get noticed.
And be sure to check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all our podcast episodes as well as our social media. We have Facebook, we have Instagram, we have Twitter. Be sure to go, like, go check out all Sean's memes. He works very hard on those memes, guys, and you know, I know he'd appreciate a few comments, a few likes, a few shares, so, you know, just go show him some love. If you want to get in contact with us, you can reach us by email at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. Send us an email, let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe you'll find us, you know, reviewing them, shredding them, tearing them apart. So on this show, we'll try not to make you cry. But, you know, if you want to come and be on the show to defend it, by all means.
You're making me blush, though. I really do have fun making those memes, and thanks for the love. I appreciate that. And if you would like to be a producer on this show and donate to us, we put in a lot of hours with no monetary gain, and we're happy to do it. But if you want to go above and beyond and donate to us, you can go to patreon.com/iusedtolikethisone and become part of our Patreon community. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.